This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
In this case, I feel like we touched a nerve, a global nerve, if you will.
We sit down for an in-depth interview with the fated New York-based architect Elizabeth Diller. We discuss why Diller nearly became a dentist, how her role in the Highline project propelled her to fame, and why artistic endeavours will always have a place at her practice. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Despite admitting to being exhausted from her latest project, The Shed in New York, Elizabeth Diller currently has other projects on the go, from the UK to China and Brazil. Back in the US, her practice, Diller, Scofidio and Renfro's greatest hits have included LA's Broad Museum and the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, not to mention the much-aped and adored Highline in Manhattan. Monocle's America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, stopped by Elizabeth Diller's studio in New York's Chelsea to delve a little deeper into the architect's beginnings.
I want to rewind now, take it back to the beginning, or not quite, but did you know you wanted to be an architect from a young age? Was there any sort of architecture in your family? How did it come about?
No, my parents are actually Holocaust survivors. We lived in Europe. I was born in Poland. And we emigrated here when I was a kid. And I had a very middle-class upbringing. My parents really started from scratch here as laborers. And it's the immigrant story. They just wanted a better life for their kids. And my mom sort of had two career paths plotted out for me. One was being an architect, and the other one was dentistry. And between those, I actually just sort of put them together and identified architecture with root canal and all the things that I hated, you know, around going to the dentist. But I always had a passion for art, and I wanted to be a filmmaker or a multimedia artist. And I went to Cooper Union and studied there, and really my whole life had been making things. So there's some point in my career at Cooper Union, I decided to take a class in architecture, and it sort of drew me. And I don't know what it was, but it wasn't necessarily about coming out of school to be a professional architect, not at all. It was about the discourse. It was about a way of thinking. So I was able to channel my sort of creative energies into thinking about space and program and conventions of the everyday. And then just one thing led to another. And we had some opportunities to build ideas in physical space and some permanently. And we just got drawn more into architecture, realizing that it's possible to actually construct ideas rather than what I had thought before, which was intellectually bankrupt. That was the preconception I had. So I'm happy today as I sort of, our career in our studio has been morphing all the time. We're taking on bigger and bigger challenges all over the world. But at the same time, this independent work continues to happen. There are always two or three independent projects that are self-generated that are going on in the studio where we need to raise money, we need to convince people to do things, sometimes by commission, but very often by just the desire to execute something in public space.
I mean, tell me about that. I feel the studio really does approach everything in such a multidisciplinary way, and that you very much have a foot in the arts world still. And even, you know, you're working, designing with Prada. I mean, there seems to be a lot going on. Do you think you're different in a way, in the fact that you still like to do all these things that aren't always, you know, profit making? You're still interested in stuff that's just in a way for the greater good or for arts in general?
Totally. I think that we are different. I think Rick and I, especially as the founding partners in the studio, are wired that way. And we will always continue to do independent experiments. One of the most recent that came off is the Mile Long Opera. On the High Line, we decided, after having worked on the High Line for so many years and seeing the huge transformation, and some for the good and some not for the good, lots of gentrification, that we really wanted to make a kind of creative response, like a post-occupancy response to it. So we decided to do this performance piece. It had to be an opera, and it had to take on this operatic project and content, which is the transformation of the city and the misaligned rhythms of its inhabitants. That was the idea. And so this piece was for 1,000 singers that were dispersed all along the mile and a half of the High Line with an audience that was basically wandering through, promenading through from start to the end and leaning in to hear these individual voices with beautiful micro stories about how their lives have changed with the transformation, rapid transformation of the city. Not necessarily about that specific site, but generally about gentrification of New York.
I was there. It was incredible. There were so many great little touches, from even the lights and the caps that the singers were wearing that sort of illuminated their faces, to people who were cleaning windows in the buildings as you walked along the High Line. I mean, we've talked about the High Line, but we haven't really talked about the High Line because, you know, this is in many ways a sort of project that really catapulted the studio to international fame. Are you surprised, looking back now, at just how many other cities around the globe have sort of referenced it and wanted to copy it, and just really how much of a reaction it's had?
One, totally surprised, and two, I'm thrilled by it. You know, in many cases, I would feel like, well, no, that's like, I would feel very possessive of a project, and if I see it repeated everywhere, I would feel somehow that it's inappropriate. But in this case, I feel like we touched a nerve, a global nerve, if you will. Today, in our culture, we're very fixed to our screens, and somehow imagine that public life, you know, doesn't matter out in physical space, but it does. And the success of the High Line in and of itself, the original High Line, is proof that people still want to come out into public space and do something as old-fashioned as walking and sitting, you know, because after all, you can't do much there. You can't really ride a bike, or you can't bring a dog, you can't throw a frisbee. You basically walk and sit. And it's turned out to be such a hit because urbanites don't actually, you know, understand the notion of doing nothing, you know, and I think it's like an invention for them. Wow, this is a place where I'm not working or burning calories or, you know, being productive. It's a place to do nothing. And I think that that spirit has really, really caught on, a kind of moment in parentheses away from everything, seeing New York from a different perspective. But where it really hit that nerve was the sort of desire to be in public space. Because of privatization of space, public space is being eaten up all the time. And it's up to policymakers all over the world to protect public space, really for the use of the public. And even if it means rethinking spent infrastructure rather than destroying it. So this is a very sustainable approach to city building.
Is the fact that you're starting to do projects from London to China to Russia and beyond, is that because you're running out of space in New York? Is it because you just want to take the studio overseas and try new places? What's the sort of motivation? Or is it the fact that you've been so successful these days that you have requests coming in from all corners of the globe?
I think it's the latter. You know, the fact that we have done all this work in New York and continue, we still have MoMA to open later this year, it's really unusual because most architects in their own cities don't see that kind of success. Usually you don't get to do anything in your own city. You get invited elsewhere, you build a reputation, and then sometime when you're in your 80s, out of some kind of feel of guilt or something like that, you get invited back to do something in your own city. In New York, we have had this incredible fortune. We were sort of beneficiaries in the Bloomberg administration that was very progressive to do projects like Lincoln Center and the High Line and Columbia University. We're doing several projects there and MoMA and other projects and installations all over. So we have been extremely lucky to be able to transform our own city. And I think that's what made people pay attention, because maybe 10, 15 years ago when we tried to get work elsewhere, it was harder because we didn't have the work to back it up. You know, we started rather late because we had an art practice for the first 15 years. So it helps to have that work behind you. But now we're in a strange time of new nationalism, so it's a little harder to actually get that work. So while it's easier because we have a reputation, it's harder because these various countries are experiencing a kind of inward focus, less international, more empowering the architects in their own countries, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. But nevertheless, we are building in Rio. We're starting a project in Budapest right now. We're doing two new projects in London. We're going to open two projects in China. And it's going to keep going, I hope.
Architect Elizabeth Diller there. We'll have more of that interview coming up a little later in the show. Stay tuned, because next we're off to survey her practice's latest building, The Shed.
Do come in. Monocle's May issue is our design special, here to help you choose the elements that will make your residence feel like a perfect home. In our review of the very best in class in the design industry, we drop into EF's brand new colourful headquarters, catch some time with busy city builder Winnie Mass, and hitch a ride on a Bauhaus bus. Elsewhere in the issue, we spend a day with Spain's Guardia Civil to make sense of the role of the country's oldest police force when nationalism is a heated topic. And we also ponder if it's all engines go for electric mobility. In our property survey, we chart the world's most interesting developments from Sydney to Ho Chi Minh City and find out a great recipe for co-living. In the culture section, we finally come clean, admit that sometimes it really is okay to judge a book by its cover, especially if it was created by one of the world's best jacket designers. Also in the issue, we meet the entrepreneurs churning out new ideas for Melbourne's vintage milk bars and stay the night in a neoclassical palazzo. Monocle's May issue is on newsstands now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
New York real estate development Hudson Yards may have taken a battering from the press of late, but not so The Shed, a shell-like arts centre in New York, which is located within the same development. Built on city land on the western flanks of Manhattan, it's a project by Diller, Scafidio and Renfro that's drawn both praise and criticism since it opened earlier in April. Monocle's Ed Stocker took a visit, and here's his report.
The Shed will have it all: theatre, music, dance, film, galleries, performance space, you name it, it will be here.
How to describe Diller, Scafidio and Renfro's newest building, The Shed? It actually brings together three building structures, but conversely, it also strives not to be a building at all, or not in the conventional sense anyway. Although it has its own independent form, The Shed is also connected to a shimmering residential tower built by the firm alongside Rockwell Group, the trade-off for being able to bring into being the Big Apple's newest cultural centre next to it. The Shed proper starts with an 8-storey rectangular block that juts out from the high-rise before connecting to a puffed-out shell-like structure. That shell, as you might expect, is what makes The Shed such a standout. It's futuristic and refuses to blend in with all the temples of luxury living and high-end retail that have sprung up around it. It's a shame, perhaps, that it's located quite so close to Thomas Heatherwick's glinting bronze climbable sculpture vessel, detracting from the impact slightly. Architecturally, though, it's not just the boldness of the structure made of EFTE, a corrosion-resistant plastic that maintains its bulging curves thanks to air pumped through its three layers. It's also a feat of engineering. From the precision plate steel shaping of the frame that was overseen by Italian firm Cimolai, to the fact that the structure is set on giant wheels on tracks that run on the outside of the building, meaning that the whole thing can either stay where it is or roll back and nest, as everyone who works on the project insists on calling it, close to the shed's permanent rectangular form. And it's still being tweaked despite opening to the public at the start of April. The shed, then, pushes the limits of a building because everything about it suggests a freedom of form and flexibility. When fully extended, it provides a vast performance space called the McCourt. But as nothing is permanently bolted down, seating arrangements and the stage position can all be shifted around. The recent standing-dominated Soundtrack of America performances will no doubt be very different to Bjork's zany arrival for her sold-out May shows. Later in the summer, we're promised the first open-air concert when the shell is, nesting. Windows and blinds are designed to be raised off the ground easily in order to allow all to seamlessly take place. Or so we hope, anyway. The programming so far has shown a similar willingness to be flexible. Overseen by artistic director Alex Poots, formerly of the UK's Manchester International Festival and NYC's Park Avenue Armoury, a current 50-minute performance that brings together musicians Steve Reich, Arvo Pärt and German painter Gerhard Richter sums it up. It starts off with viewers standing in one room looking at the colourful repetitive patterns of the large Richter works on the walls before singers in the centre of the room start to perform, walking around the space. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Once that ends, the crowd flows into the adjoining gallery and takes seats for a performance and film. Indoor or outdoor, seated or standing, mega show or more intimate gallery performance, Dilla, Scofidio and Renfro have helped ensure a stackable, slidable and very democratic new cultural hub for the city. For Monocle in New York, I'm Ed Stocker.
We're back with our second part of the interview with Elizabeth Diller. Now, Monocle's Ed Stocker started by asking her what it felt like to finally unveil The Shed earlier this month and her thoughts on the criticism it's drawn from certain circles.
It's amazing, after 11 years of invention, persuasion and very, very hard work, that we finally opened to the public. And it's such a joyful opening with all these fantastic activities happening in the building, which is why the whole building was imagined in the first place.
Some of the media has been quite negative about Hudson Yards and sort of what it represents for New York. How have you found hearing reactions like that?
So I expected the press. It's a very massive development, but it allowed us to have this unique opportunity to do a true experiment. We had a piece of property that was open on three sides, and we could actually control the fourth, and we had some open space next to us, so we could truly exploit space in New York. And the shed sits on sovereign land. It's owned by the city, will be protected by the city, and the shed in itself has total free rein. It does not have really anything to do with the commercial development. So while that development is a backdrop, it's exactly the thing that allowed us to be opportunistic and get what we want in terms of property and infrastructure and adjacent property. So we effectively tripled our footprint. None of the actual space of the fixed building or the shed needs to be used in support of anything. It is totally used for cultural public space.
I might add that although Hudson Yards has been referred to as for the 0.1%, the New York Times also said that the shed could be for the other 99.9%. So how does that make you feel that it's being viewed as this democratic institution? And have you been happy with the initial cultural programming in the opening first few weeks?
Yeah, I think that the shed was always conceived as a democratic, welcoming place. And it was meant to build new audiences and not the same standard audience that you would necessarily get to the Brooklyn Academy of Music or to Lincoln Center or to MoMA. And this intention is supported really by the programming. So it's not just the building that feels democratic. The programming has been really supportive of all of our efforts. So the initial programming has been really supportive of this. Alex Boots, the artistic director and CEO, has envisioned a kind of complex puzzle of programming in four dimensions. And there are multiple things happening in the building at once. One of the really great programming ideas came from Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave. And the program is five nights of concerts of the history of African-American music. And it's a family tree, basically, of the roots in the 17th century, coming all the way up to our current time and the artists that are just emerging. So all of the performers were young performers that many people would not know, most of us don't know, and were just introduced to them. And they had to pick a lineage back and find their own roots and sing that. So for five nights, we heard multiple singers, very new singers, brought to the stage.
I want to talk about this idea of not, decidedly not playing it safe. I feel that may be something the studio does from, you know, the Blur building to the shed, which is this, you know, building that really does stand out. It doesn't blur into its surroundings. It's defiant. Has that always been something you think that's important? That you need to, I guess, have a strong sense of identity and not be afraid to take some risks?
Well, most of the projects that we do are sort of experiments, and it's a kind of evolving agenda. The Blur building, for example, we wanted to make a building out of the site that it sits on, which is a lake. So we wanted to make a building out of water. It's made of 35,000 fog nozzles that are basically, there's a system that pumps the water from the lake, filters it, and then shoots it out of these high-pressure nozzles. And you come into the structure, which is floating over the lake, and it's like a cloud, and you get lost in it, and you can't be dependent on vision as the master sense, you know, and you have this white noise, shh, of the nozzles, and it's a very transporting experience. But we wanted to make this cloud that's inhabitable, and we didn't know how to do it, and so we jumped in, and we said we'd figure it out, and we brought in a lot of smart people around us, engineers and agriculture fog specialists and water treatment specialists and so forth. And we built this thing, which was a tremendous success. But along the way, we discovered like this thing that we hadn't thought of. That lake, Lake Neuchâtel, was actually polluted and it needed extra filtration. Otherwise, the entire population of Switzerland would get Legionnaires' disease. And of course, we figured it out and we worked with, again, with smart people to figure out how to filter the water properly. And like most of our projects, we sort of jump out of an airplane and we're not sure we're holding on to a parachute. And on the way down, we hope to open it and have a soft landing. So the shed is another example. So our projects are very much propelled by concepts, ideas that often require unusual means. And out of naivete and of sheer desire and passion, we will these things into happening.
Does it get easier the more well-known and the more international repute you have to take risks in a way?
I think we have a little bit more street cred than we had when we started. But still, each project is a challenge in itself. And we keep looking for the next challenge which is going to be always a little harder than the last one. I think it's just in our nature.
Let's focus in to finish on New York City. Is there something, if you could wave a magic wand and you were to do just one more project in New York City, what would it be?
Okay, the magic wand would be to make all the ground floor lobbies of all the buildings in New York public space. One utopian vision, public space that's continuous and unstoppable through all of New York.
Not ambitious at all then?
Not at all. I will try to pull it off.
It's been a pleasure, as always, speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Diller speaking to Monocle's America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, in New York. And it's with regret that that's all the time we have on today's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our fantastically named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of the magazine, which is available at all self-respecting newsstands or monocle.com. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.